Well, good morning, all. Hey, good to see everybody here. We got a nice crowd. Got some special visitors here today, too, and we're grateful that you're here. Laverna Bellis is back in town. She's not a visitor. She's family, and she's home, and we're glad of that. But my mom is here today, so don't tell on me. Last week we started talking about the last week of Jesus' life before his crucifixion, and we're going to continue that today. In that last week, the disciples didn't quite follow what was happening. We talked last week about the need for change and the realization that on Sunday and Monday and Tuesday, Jesus continued to talk about the need that people had to change their lives to be more what God intended for them to be. Today we're going to continue on in Mark chapter 14. If you want to get a head start, we're going to go ahead and turn there. While you're turning to Mark 14, let me just remind you of something about Oklahoma generally. We get these summer thunderstorms. And you know how these summer thunderstorms work. You're outside and you're doing some yard work or whatever, and it's hot and humid and it's a little bit windy and the clouds start to build and you look around and you think, well, this is thunderstorm weather, you know, we could have a storm through this. Yeah. And you're out there and you continue to work and the clouds continue to build out there and it just gets hotter and hotter and you think, this is stormy weather, we're going to have a storm. And the sky gets darker and darker and darker and you're convinced, you know that we're about to have a storm. And then it gets suddenly very, very still. And there's no wind at all. And you can hear a bird a half mile away. And you think, we are definitely going to have a thunderstorm. And then there's this sudden gust of cold air on you, and all of a sudden it just opens up on you, and the thunderstorm arrives. And you knew all along that it was coming, but the suspense just kept building and building and building because you didn't know when it was going to come. You knew it was coming, but you didn't know when it was going to come. Something like that has happened to the disciples in this last week. They know something is happening. The suspense just continues to build in them. On Sunday and Monday and Tuesday, Jesus was talking about the need for change, and he talked about how everything needed to change in people's lives. They needed to put their lives more in line with God's will. Now it's Wednesday, and Jesus begins to talk about the promise of change. But a promise of change doesn't always sound like happy news. See, change always creates anxiety in us. We have to let go of the old in order to take hold of the new. And nobody really likes to do that. We want to hold on to the things that are familiar to us, even when they don't seem to work very well. We just can't quite give up the old in order to take hold of the new. Jesus tells us we absolutely have to do that. There's this promise of change in us. It's rare, I suppose, that change comes as a deliberate strategy. We get kind of anxious about change because we assume that change comes about from forces outside our control, that we're just being forced to do things differently. Circumstances have changed, and now we've got to adjust. We don't often think about change coming as a deliberate strategy. But that's exactly what Jesus is doing, a deliberate strategy. This is something that God had planned all along. Now, this whole event takes place at Passover time, and Passover is supposed to be this time of joyous celebration. God chose His people and drew them out of Egypt with the Exodus. Mighty hand and an outstretched arm. They passed through the Red Sea. They received the law. They were brought into their own land and given an identity as the people of God. This is supposed to be a great and joyous celebration of that time, and it's not sounding very happy because Jesus says some things here that really disturb the disciples. Here it's Wednesday, and on Wednesday, and then again on Thursday, Jesus is going to say three words. And these three words disturb the disciples. They make them think that this promise of change is not necessarily happy news. But the truth of the matter is, this promise of change was always part of God's ancient plan. This is not chaos. They don't exactly know how it's going to work out, but this isn't chaos. This is part of God's plan. Let's go to Mark chapter 14. And we're going to look at these three words in Mark chapter 14. And we're going to start, let's just start at the very beginning, shall we? Because from the very beginning, Jesus mentions the word burial. And that disturbs people. Let's go to Mark chapter 14, verse 1, and read the first 9 verses together. And let's just think about what the disciples hear. Now the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and teachers of the law were looking for some sly way to arrest Jesus and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or the people may riot. While he was in Bethany reclining at the table in the home of a man known as Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, "Why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor." And they rebuked her harshly. "Leave her alone," said Jesus. "Why are you bothering her? She's done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them anytime you want, but you will not always have me." She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. I tell you the truth, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. He used the word burial, and this brings up a good deal of anxiety in the disciples because, oh, he's been talking about death. Three times now he said he's going to go up to Jerusalem and die. They didn't quite get it, but we use the word die as a figure of speech all the time, don't we? Got in last night, I was really tired, fell into bed and just died. Everybody understands what you mean. That comedian was up on stage, he wasn't funny at all, he just died. We use that figure of speech all the time. People don't use burial in that way. And consequently, what Jesus is talking about is something that is very permanent. If he's going to be buried, then the disciples' lives are going to change. For 3 years, they've been wandering around with him, listening to him preach and teach, and they've been trying to carry his message to others, but now he's saying that something is going to change all that, and that change is annoyingly permanent. Burial is pretty irreversible. And yet, from the reading that Link did, you know, I'm so grateful that Link did that reading for us. That was kind of a long and involved reading, but it's really important that we hear those words from Isaiah 53 because that was a prediction that was made 750 years in advance that this is not just haphazard. That God actually has a plan in this. This change is a change that is planned. If we were to go back to Isaiah 53 and look at verse 9, for example, verse 9 says, "He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he'd done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth." For 750 years, this had been lurking in the background because God had talked about a grave for his servant. And it's true that the rabbis didn't really understand Isaiah 52 and 3 and 4 and 5. They still don't quite get it, and it's very puzzling. But for 750 years, this had been in the background. Clearly, something is going to change. Something's going to change. And although the disciples are caught in suspense here and their anxiety continues to mount, there's a message of assurance in this, and the assurance is that God really is in control. This thing that is happening is not an accident. You know, we think of change coming just by circumstances change and we're being forced to do things differently. This is by the plan of God. God's in control. He knows exactly what he's doing. Jesus, in fact, was honored in his burial. He's with the rich in his death. Now, the disciples are not thinking about this. I don't want to give you the wrong impression here. The disciples aren't thinking about this. All they hear is this very disturbing word, burial. And they're not thinking about how this all meshes with the things that God has said in the past. They're just very anxious because this means something is going to change. And what will it mean for them? There is a promise of change. But the change is planned. And then the next day, this happens on Wednesday, the next day on Thursday, Jesus says another word that disturbs them. And the word that Jesus says the next day is the word covenant. Let's go to chapter 14. Start down in verse 22 with me. We'll read down through verse 25. You know the scene. They're in the upper room. Jesus says going to eat the Passover meal with them. They've prepared it all. And during the meal, Jesus does something strange. And he says some things that disturb them. Beginning in verse 22. While they were eating, Jesus took bread, gave thanks and broke it and gave it to the disciples, saying, "Take it, this is my body." Then he took the cup, gave thanks and offered it to them, and they all drank from it. "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many," he said to them. "I tell you the truth, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it anew in the kingdom of God." Jesus said the word covenant. And the anxiety for the disciples is this word covenant means that things changing are changing too radically. We already have a covenant. The disciples would have thought that you're calling for a new covenant here, but we've already got a covenant. And in fact, the covenant that we have defines our whole culture. We are who we are because of the covenant that we have with God. It was in the Exodus that God brought us out, and He gave us a law, and He gave us sacrifices, and He gave us rituals to follow, and the right kind of clothing to wear, and taught us how to deal with other people, and everything about our culture is bound up in this covenant. And now Jesus is talking about a new covenant. And what in the world will that mean to us? If there is a new covenant, how will that change our culture? You remember that change demands letting go of the old to seize the new. And that is really scary. It scares a lot of people to think about letting go of the old. But in that passage in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 10, there was a hint of a new covenant. In chapter 53, verse 10, Isaiah says, "Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer, and though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand." Guilt offering? Wait a minute, we've already got a guilt offering. We know about guilt offerings. The Jews understood there's a guilt offering. They do it every day down there at the temple. We understand what guilt offerings are about. But if Jesus says he's going to be the guilt offering, if Isaiah predicts someone, a servant, to be the guilt offering, that means there's got to be a new covenant involved. And there were other warnings in the Old Testament. There were, you know, not just 750 years before, but 150 years after Isaiah, Jeremiah had come along and expressly said, "In those days, I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. It will not be like that former covenant I made when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt." There's a plain prediction of a new covenant. There were other passages throughout the Old Testament that talked about the coming of a new covenant. And yet this word fills the disciples with anxiety. What is going to happen now? They don't see how it will all work out. But there's assurance in this. The assurance is that God really does care for His people. Those of you who were in this adult Bible class we did the last few months, we talked about the shift in covenants and the continuity. And we pointed out that over and over God had changed the covenants, and every time He changed the covenants, He enhances it. He makes it better. And so you have that covenant with Noah, and it was enhanced because when Abraham came along, God made a covenant with Abraham, much better covenant. Then Moses brought the covenant of the law, and it was an enhancement and an expansion of the earlier covenant with Abraham. And then David's covenant was an enhancement yet, and now there's a new covenant coming, and every time God has made a different covenant during these times, it has been an enhancement. It's been better because God cares for His people. Here, God has a glorious covenant in mind. Now, the disciples don't know that. They don't know what God has in mind. All they hear is the distant rumble of thunder. And the suspense continues to grow in them. Things are changing. There's a promise of change, and they don't know how it's going to work out. Understandably, they're very anxious about their future. What is this going to mean? And then Jesus upset them yet worse with another word. And this comes late that same evening. as they leave the upper room, they go out to the Garden of Gethsemane, and Jesus uses the word sorrow. Let's go back to Mark chapter 14 and start reading in verse 32. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." Going a little farther, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." The word sorrow would bring some anxiety to the disciples because it seems that this change is going to involve some discomfort. It's not necessarily going to be a happy time. You know, if change is good, you just tell me all the benefits to it. If it's a good thing that's going to happen, you tell me how it's going to make me smarter or stronger, or live longer, or happier. You know, tout the benefits of the change. Jesus is using the word sorrow here. And the disciples have to ask, what have I done? I've tied myself to him, and I've followed him for all this time, and I've listened to his preaching and teaching. What is it that I have done with my life now? Yeah, you've had that experience, haven't you, at different times in your life? You look around and think, oh, what have I done? You know, for a lot of women, that's about 2 days after saying, "I do." Then they say, "What have I done?" That happens to us sometimes. You say, what have I done? Was this smart? They go into the garden and they fall asleep. I've often wondered about that. How could they fall asleep? This is Jesus' last night on the earth with them, and he begs them to pray, and they fall asleep. You know, Luke chapter 22, verse 45, there's a little bitty explanatory note there. Because Luke points out there, they were exhausted from sorrow. It's depression. You ever get just kind of worn out? You're just so unhappy. All you want to do is go to sleep. That's what the disciples are doing. The suspense is building in them. They don't know what's going to happen. Something bad, plainly, is going to happen. Jesus has talked about burial, a change in covenants. Now he's talking about his own sorrow. Everything is going to change somehow. There's something bad on the horizon. And in Isaiah 53, verse 11, God said, "After the suffering of his soul, he'll see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities." This change is a planned change. Suffering is a part of the change. We tend to think of suffering always as something negative, but God seems to think that it's a necessary part of this change. But it's not the end of it. It's part of it, but it's not the end of it. This suffering has a purpose. Most people who have undergone some severe testing, some trial, some hospitalization or surgery or something like that, they just want to be sure that what they've undergone is not purposeless. They realize there's pain in life. Bad things just happen. They do. But they want to make sure that it's not empty, valueless. God assures his servant that the suffering is full of purpose. There's a reason for all of this, and the assurance in that is that God tells us the truth. He always, always, always tells us the truth. I want to demonstrate that to you. I don't know. I get emails from people all the time. Got an email this past week from a friend. Actually, I got about 3 or 4 copies of the same email. Y'all remember that there was a minister who was shot and killed in Tennessee a few weeks ago, right? You remember? Was in the news. It was, you know, a fairly big deal. And then on a CNN show, this woman invited a denominational pastor to come and talk about churches of Christ. Now, she could have picked up the phone book and, you know, called the local church, and somebody would have been glad to come down and explain it to her. But instead, she chose somebody else to come in and explain, you know, what's wrong with these nuts? Who are these kooky folks out here? And we got pretty well vilified. I mean, we were handled really badly, and some very unkind and ugly things were said about us there, which happens sometimes. Anyway, this one writer wrote to me and said, don't you think, you know, we got to do something about this now. We need to write angry protest emails and tell this woman on CNN that she's got it all wrong. We get somebody on there who can tell the truth about us. And I wrote back and I said, look, I don't think we need to do anything about this, and I'll tell you why. Number one, it was on CNN, which means that like 8 people saw it. Number two, we've always been ripped by people who don't like us. We've always heard these kinds of things, haven't we? I mean, you know, we've been handled badly. Third reason is you can always create a lot more controversy and dredge up a lot more publicity by doing this. The smart thing, in my view, is just let it die down. If somebody comes and asks a question, we'll be happy to answer the question and try to straighten this out. But the fact of the matter is, Jesus said a long time ago, the world will hate you. Didn't he say that? Yeah, he said that. He said that this very night. God always tells us the truth. He warned us that these things would happen. He always tells us the truth. The change that takes place in us will involve some discomfort, too. You've all heard the expression, no pain, no gain, right? We usually use that in terms of sports performance. You got to go out and practice, or maybe musical ability. You got to practice and stay after it. There's discipline involved here. No pain, no gain. Guess what? It's true in the spiritual realm, too. The disciples here this last night, they're hearing a promise of change, and that promise is not always happy news. There's always anxiety involved with change. People naturally ask these questions. There's going to be a change. What does that mean? What does that mean to my life? What's it going to do in my life? People ask those questions. They ask questions like, what will I be when all this is over? What will my life be like when this change takes place? People very naturally ask the question, what am I going to gain by this? You're telling me I need to change and do things differently. What am I going to gain? And more importantly, they ask the question, what am I going to lose? What is this going to cost me? The suspense is just building in these disciples. And now things are going to change. And they've heard this promise of change. And the question in their minds is, how can they be okay with all this? They don't know where it's going to take them. They don't know how this is going to work out from here. How can they be okay with it? And the only answer to that is, you need to trust Jesus. You just need to trust Him. Change always requires that we let go of the old and take hold of the new. I know that's scary. I know that's a scary thought. And I know also that this is a difficult problem for people who hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because they know they're being asked to change. They know there's a call to change. And they ask the same kinds of questions. When people say, you need to trust Jesus, you need to obey the gospel of Christ, commit yourself to Him, they ask questions like, what do I lose by doing this? That's a perfectly normal, natural question. And I bet you've had people ask you that question. What do I have to give up this or this or this in order to be a Christian? You know, what am I going to lose in this? What's this going to cost me? And then they ask questions like, what do I gain in this? You're telling me I'm going to, you know, why is this a better thing for me? What do I gain? And then the last question, the most important one is it worth it? You telling me I've got to change and do things differently, is it worth it? The answer on that is the same answer that the disciples had to confront. It's time to trust Jesus. I can't tell you what will change in your life by following Jesus Christ. I don't know. I know some things will change. I can tell you some things that changed in my life, and I can tell you, yes, it was worth it. You better believe it was worth it. And I know that you're going to be called to change some things. And it's time to trust Jesus and just make the move. The plan is not a haphazard, chaotic accident. It's part of God's ancient plan for the redemption of humanity. This last week of Jesus' life, the suspense is just building and building and building, because truly the disciples don't know how it's going to work out. But they know that God has a plan, and all they can do is hang on. If you're not a Christian this morning, we're going to sing an invitation song and give you an opportunity to respond to Jesus' invitation. I don't know all the things that will change in your life, but I know that if you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, you're going to have to trust yourself to Him. In your faith, in your belief, you're going to have to confess His name before men like every other Christian has. You're going to have to repent of sin, stop doing the wrong thing, start doing the right thing. You call that a loss? I call that a gain. Stop doing the wrong thing. Start doing the right thing in its place. You're going to have to be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins. Reenacting Jesus' death, His burial, His resurrection from the dead. That's the moment at which His blood cleanses you of sin. You're going to have to do that, because that's what every person this side of the cross has done. And then you're going to need to live with Him daily. And yes, it's going to mean some changes. And that's not always a happy thought, but it's always a necessary thought. If you're not a Christian, you can obey the gospel today and obtain that life. If you are a Christian, though, you've made the covenant with Christ in the past in that way, but you haven't lived with Him, you haven't lived for Him. Maybe you thought you just gave up too much. What have I done? What have I done? Well, I'll tell you what you did. You committed yourself to the living Lord God. If you haven't been living for Him and doing His will, you need to turn it around. You need to come back to Him and give your life entirely to Him. I know the suspense is strong, but the storm will break. If you need to respond publicly to Jesus' invitation, we urge you to do it right now while we stand together and sing the song.